There's been a gloomy assessment of the economy from the Bank of England. It predicts a period without growth and doesn't rule out a recession.
When Roosevelt came to the land of the hummingbird, shouts of welcome were heard. When Roosevelt came to the land of the hummingbird, shouts of welcome were heard. His visit to their island is bound to be an epoch in local history. Definitely marking a new era, keeping Trinidad in America. For this great man, jubilation was evinced by the entire population. Friendship for the USA was shown, and from his house the stars and the stripes were flown. For the state threw open the gates to the president of these United States. In fact, everybody was glad to welcome Roosevelt to Trinidad.
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, the weekly programme that campaigns for a safe climate, that's made for Resonance FM in London and syndicated to community stations around the globe. This week we take a look at a policy package put forward by a new group calling itself the Green New Deal, which aims to address the triple challenges of the credit crunch, climate change and high oil prices. All three of these phenomena pose major threats to the global economy if they are left untreated. The Green New Deal team currently includes the Guardian newspaper's economics editor Larry Elliott, former head of the Jubilee 2000 debt relief campaign Anne Pettifor, former directors of Friends of the Earth Tony Juniper and Charles Secret, chairman of Solar Century Jeremy Leggett, and Caroline Lucas, MEP. The group's inaugural report draws lessons from the policy packages that were devised by economist John Maynard Keynes in the UK and President Franklin D. Roosevelt in the United States to deal with the Depression of the 1930s. I asked Andrew Sims, policy director of the New Economics Foundation and one of the report's authors, to remind us what exactly the original 1930s New Deal was.
If we think back to 1929, people think there was a sudden moment at which the financial system fell apart in the United States. It didn't actually happen like that. It was a creeping financial crisis that took months to unfold. But when it did unfold, it undermined the economy of what was the emerging economic superpower of the day. In response to that, unusually, people became aware of the distorting power of finance for the wider productive economy and for social stability. And the president at the time, Roosevelt, was able to come up with a program of action which sought to both rein in the more reckless aspects of the financial system, but also to lay a foundation for rebuilding the economy, which targeted help and support at agriculture, farmers, small farmers, as well as wider parts of the economy. And he did that in 1933 by putting together a political coalition and support for a 100-day program of regulatory action that was designed to both tackle the more reckless aspects of the finance sector, but also to reflate the economy by having massive investment in a wide range of issues. And one of the things, one of the kind of forgotten chapters, is the creation of the Civilian Conservation Corps, which really laid the foundations for quite a lot of the modern American environmental movement.
One of the things that I like about the Green New Deal report is the opening chapter, which is a great layman's guide to the current credit crunch, and which might presage another kind of great depression, perhaps, particularly with the converging crisis, the triple crunch that you're describing. Mm. So from your perspective, the 9th of August 2007 seems to have been detonation day. What happened on that day?
that was the date at which basically confidence left the financial system and banks stopped lending to each other. What that revealed was the degree to which the economies of the United States and Britain were built upon an unsustainable boom in credit, or to give it its kind of proper name in this context, in debt, and debt built on no solid foundations. And of course, as soon as that confidence left the system, it exposed the way in which the subprime lending patterns in the United States had misjudged fundamentally the security behind which they were making much broader lending available in the economy. And of course, rather like a sort of house of cards, the moment one person stopped, one bank stopped lending to the next bank, you saw the consequences. You saw the beginnings of what is still a rolling collapse of the banking system, in effect, and confidence in the system. For me, it said something more than that. It exposed the degree to which the financial system has drifted away from any meaningful connection with what you or I might understand as being the real economy of natural resources, the real economy of the productive base of the economy, of the social provision of care and health services and education, and the way in which what we understand as being meaningful economic and social interactions, which make up the real economy, how this had drifted fundamentally away from the esoteric world of high finance and the creation of exotic financial instruments that are held aloft by nothing more than the faith and expectations of people working in the city and their ability to talk them up and talk their value up. And of course, as soon as that sort of absence of any real foundation to that was exposed, the whole thing came tumbling down.
One thing I'm getting from reading your analysis is that there's a lot of risky debt that has been concealed in tax havens, which has been assisted by the four big auditing companies. And those auditing companies are actually being forced to make more accurate assessments of that risky debt in order to... They're fearful of being implicated in Enron-style collusion. So globally, we've seen something like $265 billion worth of bad debt written off so far by banks. I mean, what's the government's response to this been so far? I mean, is it within their control to manage this crisis?
There's absolutely no doubt that governments still set the regulatory framework, and there's been an intense debate over recent years about what should be common international accounting standards. I think the problem is that whilst regulation of, in the case of the UK and the US, I would say inadequate regulation of the financial system, but nevertheless, regulation of the financial system has remained a sort of primarily national affair, whilst of course the global economy has done exactly that. It's gone global. And I think the hemorrhage of resources, of what should be legitimate resources to be raised by governments to invest in society, and it's the old line that tax is the price you pay for civilization, and of course if you lose too much tax, you lose the ability to pay for the basic underpinning of society and civilization. And I think one of the problems with economic globalization, financial liberalization of the last few decades, is that it's made it ever easier for capital to find places to hide, and also for sort of, as you make the point, for bad debts to be concealed. I think we're still waiting for global regulation to grow up to meet the challenges of a global economy. It's almost as if there's always a lag between what happens in the economy and the regulatory environment. If you look back in Britain's own history to the 19th century, you saw the emergence of a kind of an aggressive industrial capitalism, and then you saw in a lag period behind that the emergence of forms of regulation to tame that at the national level. What we've seen is a similar experience at the global level, and an aggressive form of global capital markets emerging, and a time lag, which we're still in at the moment, in which regulation has not caught up with it. But I think there should be no doubt that markets are not innate natural forces. They are, to a greater or lesser extent, regulated by governments, and it is a policy decision to allow the ever easier movement of capital around the globe, and it will be a policy decision to stop that. I think that there's now very much a shared interest in a wide range of constituencies, ranging from productive aspects and parts of industry, the sort of the broader real economy, the labour movement, the environmental movement, to come together and basically to put finance back into its place and say that finance is there to serve the wider economy and society. And at the moment, it's been privileged in the system and given preferential treatment and treated with far too much deference, to the point where it's become the master when it should be the servant. And I think there's an interesting political moment, an interesting political opportunity now, where a new alliance of people who represent sort of real society and the real economy can come together and say, you know, it's time for finance to be put back into its box and to play the facilitating role which it is supposed to do.
This is hard stuff to swallow, isn't it, for people that have been advocating deregulation of financial markets and the globalisation of financial markets since the 70s. How are they going to deal with this?
I think it is a hard one to swallow, but already you're beginning to see, whether it's former chiefs of the International Monetary Fund or leader writers on the Financial Times, you know, people working in the finance sector or reporting on the finance sector, representing the finance sector, are seeing the emergence of systemic crises. They understand that this period of progressive liberalisation of capital and finance has enabled a greater volatility, a greater instability of markets, and even there, in the sort of the heart of the beast, so to speak, there is an awareness that something has got to change. So I think it is all to play for now, and there is an awareness and an appetite for change and re-regulation of that sector.
Confidence seems to be declining in the economy. Is there more bad debt to be revealed? Is there a danger of economic meltdown? One thing that's pointed out in the report is these things called credit default swaps, which is basically a lot of bank debt is insured by these mechanisms which are unregulated and might not give the banks sufficient protection if a large number of companies start to default on bank loans.
I mean, one of the things that we've called for in the report is for all exotic instruments like this to be effectively officially vetted and checked for whether they represent a systemic risk to the wider system. And I think part of the problem is that we are still seeing almost on a daily basis weaknesses in the system further exposed, and we're seeing people from the major financial institutions like the IMF still saying that there is worse to come. It's not exactly the definition of a sort of a pyramid or a Ponzi scheme, but it is a little bit like that when you have made large amounts of lending available built upon bad and irrecoverable debts, and the moves to effectively re-nationalise some of the major mortgage lending arms in the United States, I think, is kind of clear demonstration of that. And we were actually seeing a kind of great phase of re-nationalisation in effect in the financial system in respect of the fact that the market has fundamentally failed. Mm. When you move into a period of instability like this, it's actually very hard to tell how far it's going to go, but I think we have not seen the end of it.
Well, moving on to the energy crunch, this idea of peak oil, essentially, and even the IEA, the International Energy Authority, seems to have admitted now that peak oil is actually real. And they're suggesting that it might happen by 2015, but other people are suggesting this might already be happening. But certainly, we're already seeing, aren't we, some effects of high oil prices, and that may be a combination of high demand at the same time as kind of peaking oil supplies.
Peak oil is a geological inevitability. You know, it's a bit like the line that Mark Twain said about, you know, if you want to invest in anything, invest in land, because they're not making any more of it. You know, we're not making more fossil fuels. So coming to terms with the fact, and I think huge sections of both the sort of political classes, but also people working in the industry, have been in deep, deep, deep denial about the geological inevitability of peak oil for a long time, in spite of the fact we've had very accurate predictions going back half a century for the production curve of major fields, going back to the sort of original guy who coined the term the Hubbert Peak, M. King Hubbert, the geologist, who predicted decades in advance to within a year when North American production would peak. So coming to terms with that has been very difficult for people, but increasingly the range of estimates coming from both existing industry people, former industry people, the representatives representative bodies like the IEA or even departments of government, we're seeing a clustering of estimates for the moment of peak oil, which basically cluster around about now in the next few years. Some people think we might already have gone past the point but not seen the market signal yet. So, you know, it's here, we're kind of living through it. Now, the degree to which the current high and volatile oil price is directly the result of that, I think it's almost certain that an anticipation of peak oil is part of that. Lots of other reasons, of geopolitical reasons and issues to do with the sort of underinvestment in infrastructure and speculation, have and are affecting the price. But I think we're beginning to see a high and rising price for oil, which is never going to fundamentally dip down to the levels it was a decade ago. Now, I think that it's almost impossible to underestimate the ripple effect that that's going to have, even on advanced industrialized economies like our own, on issues to do with fuel poverty. And it makes current government policies, which still seem to be geared towards locking in fossil fuel intensive infrastructure, whether it's a third runway at Heathrow or a new generation of coal-fired power stations, seem even crazier than they were before. Some people turn around and say, well, doesn't peak oil mean you've got a built-in solution to climate change? Ironically, it may well see an acceleration of climate change, because we are already witnessing the way in which the oil companies are seeking out the more peripheral and more highly polluting sources of fossil fuels like tar sands, etc. And of course, from a developing country perspective, developing countries that have access to large reserves of dirtier forms of coal and brown coal, it's going to likely increase the extraction and use of those dirtier forms of fossil fuels. So peak oil is, I think, a very complicated issue, in the sense that it's going to send a very powerful price signal that could well see some very positive things, like the rapid growth of the renewable sector, the rapid increase of home insulation, which is another way of tackling fuel poverty, and a broad swathe of other energy conservation measures. And yet, at the same time, it's going to make other forms of dirtier fossil fuels seem more economically attractive. So I think it's a complicated issue. It's certainly potentially one of the biggest shocks to the global economy that we will have witnessed, and could easily rival and surpass the shock that's been sent from the credit crunch.
I mean, Colin Campbell draws out the kind of economic implications of peak oil and says, once people understand that the oil-based economy is in permanent terminal decline, that will remove the confidence in the perpetual growth on which the financial system depends, and borrowing and lending will dry up. And in turn, this will lead to the conclusion that the world faces another Great Depression. So this is another threat to the economy, the second threat that you're trying to address in your report. Should we move on to the climate crunch?
Well, I think the simple point that the convergence of the energy crunch and the credit crunch, when you kind of attach that to a clearer and more simple understanding of the limits of the Earth's biocapacity and the flexible but ultimately fixed shoe size that the global economy has to kind of fit into, it leads you to one unavoidable conclusion, that we have to find a way of making the economy live within its environmental means. We have to find a way of meeting and paying for the basic elements that a society needs to hold itself together, to feed itself, to care for itself, to provide the stuff of life day to day, but to do that without depending upon unsustainable, indefinite growth. I think that is the huge conclusion, and what that does mean is we do need to reorient and think afresh about how we are going to meet the needs of people in their old age, how we are going to meet the needs of all the different forms of care that communities and societies need, and to do that without depending upon an expectation in the city that large companies will return 10+% growth year on year on year. I think it's going to filter through to revisions of company law, which make that a fiduciary duty of companies to do that, to meet the shareholder expectations. I think it's going to see such a revolution in the way that we think about the economy and how we think about meeting our needs, and a reorientation, I think, to things that really matter, to what's being called by Edgar Cayce, the American sort of deviser of time banks, a refocus on the core economy, and the core economy being that unpaid for part of the economy that provides care to young and old and holds the fabric of society together. And it's going to mean reorientation towards different forms of economic exchange, which are not necessarily cash-based. It's going to mean different forms of currency, which is underpinned not by the imaginary waving of the wand of the exotic financial instruments which have brought the economy to its perilous state at the moment, but based upon real things like the productive biocapacity that we have available in our fisheries, fields and forests to provide the basic stuff of life. But we're going to have to find a way that we do that in a state of dynamic equilibrium with the flexible but ultimately fixed biocapacity that the Earth has available. So I think you cannot underestimate the degree to which this involves a fundamental rethink of how we're doing things. That said, I don't think that based upon our research to do with human well-being and life satisfaction, I don't think that necessarily means that we have to look forward to a sort of miserable hair shirt existence. On the contrary, I think there's an awful lot to say that beyond the point where you've got the basic stuff of life met, where you have enough food to eat, a roof over your head, clothes to wear, and enough to be able to provide yourself with a satisfying sexual life, that rising income above, and levels of material consumption above and beyond that do not translate through into higher levels of life satisfaction. Our own work shows that for the last three, more than the last three decades, whilst our GDP has been going up and up, our life satisfaction has flatlined. Our challenge globally is to make sure that we meet basic needs and to design our lives in such a way that people can flourish and grow as individuals, but not premised upon endlessly rising conspicuous consumption, because that is fundamentally unsustainable. It may well be that going through the period of adjustment that we're going to need to do anyway in the face of the triple crunch of high energy prices, the limits, the biophysical limits that climate change imposes, and the credit crunch, that we find a better, more rich and enduring and fruitful ways of living that can get us off the endless treadmill of rising consumer consumption and endlessly chasing that larger house and bigger car, things which we know when we get them might give us a very short fillip but ultimately leave us dissatisfied and wanting ever more. So it may well be that the triple crunch shock that we're living through at the moment will be just the thing which is necessary to jumpstart us onto a different development path in which we learn to live within our environmental limits and lead more rich lives with a higher degree of well-being as a result.
Can we look at some of the specific solutions that you're proposing in the final section of the report? And firstly, there's a kind of big programme of public works, really, in a sense, but low-carbon infrastructure, which is kind of akin to the Roosevelt-style New Deal. Can you tell us a little bit about that and ideas?
I think in the short term, what we need to see, given the period of time that we think we're working with, and it may be that from this month of August 2008, that we might have globally as little as 100 months before we reach a new, more perilous phase of climate change. So we know we have to re-engineer our economies very, very rapidly. On this occasion, and in some specific ways, there is that rare political opportunity for a real win-win. And we believe that a major program of investment akin to the kind of investments that were made as part of Roosevelt's original New Deal, but a major program of investment in environmental transformation, looking at the energy supply infrastructure we have in the UK, looking at the rehabilitation and renovation of the housing and building stock, will not only give us a route out of short-term recession, it will generate a significant amount of employment, ranging from low through to high-skill jobs, and at the same time jumpstart us onto a path of greater sustainability. Now, we think that's the place to start, but we certainly wouldn't want to stop there, because there's other aspects of our transport infrastructure, of the way that our food system operates, that would also be ripe for a program of environmental transformation that could have massive economic benefits and job creation potential. So I think that's the substantial low-hanging fruit that offers us an immediate opportunity. Now, as that unfolds over time, it raises wider, longer questions about how we might progressively reduce our level of material consumption and free up time in the economy to be able to spend it on things that we know really do deliver higher levels of well-being. That means time for your family, it means time for your friends, it means time for your individual pursuits and your own personal learning, lifelong learning opportunities for that. So, I mean, ideally in a medium to longer term period, we can imagine a situation in which people may indeed, because they might be working a shorter week, have a lower income, but they might have a higher level of well-being because they're freed up to spend time on things which really do deliver, and which there is an enormous literature to demonstrate really does deliver higher levels of human well-being. So we envisage what superficially might be seen in some senses an orthodox economic approach to how you might jumpstart some new emerging nascent economic sectors, but in ways which have enormous economic benefits and which might insulate and inoculate the economy against the threat of recession tipping over into depression, then translating that through and transferring that and transitioning that into a medium to long-term program of some really sort of fundamental re-engineering of the economy. Now, we know through some historical examples under very different circumstances, admittedly, and under in the face of very different threats, that we know that these things are not only possible, but can also deliver unexpected, positive, and emerging consequences.
You seem to have launched quite a comprehensive solution to the triple crunch, as you describe it, which we're now facing. And you seem to be pretty much occupying what otherwise from the main political parties is a kind of policy vacuum, really, to deal adequately with the threats that we now face. I mean, there is talk about, within the Labour Party, for a windfall tax, perhaps in the autumn, to boost Gordon Brown's popularity in some quarters. But beyond that, how do you see advancing this platform and getting the major parties to talk in these kind of terms?
Well, the Green New Deal group itself was deliberately formed with a range of expertise from renewable energies to the finance system to the broader environmental movement. And the idea is that it should be the beginnings, an invitation to begin a broader political alliance that represents both the productive parts of the economy and industry, workforce through the labour movement, the environmental movement, and sort of a broad alliance that can advance a programme which has shared interests and the possibility for some genuine political double wins. Now, the windfall tax is an interesting example. It's one of the mechanisms that we suggest, and it's a mechanism we've been suggesting for the last 2 years, given the fact that the fossil fuel industries themselves have already enjoyed both a double windfall. One windfall is the geological windfall of the fossil fuels themselves, the second windfall being the high and rising price. And we think that's an obvious place to start to begin to find some of the capital necessary for the transition for the new model. So what we did with this report, it goes into some detail in some areas. In other areas, it's sketching out a broad approach. It needs a lot more work, it needs a lot more detail, and it's an open invitation to people in all of those different constituencies, whether it's people actually working in the, you know, more enlightened elements of the finance sector themselves, people working in industry, people working in the unions, in the environmental movement, to come forward and enhance it and improve it and develop it, because there are areas in which we are a long way short of having a sort of week by week, month by month detailed plan of implementation. But this is an invitation to have a new political alliance which leaves behind a lot of the old sort of conventional party distinctions and saying, here is a project that is in all our interests, that can deliver for everybody in all those fundamental parts of society and sectors of the economy, and we want to take it forward from there.
That was Andrew Sims, Policy Director of the New Economics Foundation, and one of the seven people that currently make up the Green New Deal Group. The group's first report is downloadable from the NEF website at www.nef.org. You've been listening to the 300 to 350 show. To hear this programme again, visit our archive of programmes at www.climateradio.co.uk.
We are privileged to see the democratic president of the great republic, with his charming and genial personality and his wonderful urbanity. We were struck by his modest style and was intrigued by the famous Roosevelt smile. No wonder everybody was glad to welcome Roosevelt to Trinidad.